All across America and around the world, this is Veterans Radio.
This is Veterans Radio.
And now, your host for today's program, Dale Thronberry.
And hello, America. Hello, world. My name is Dale Thronberry, and I get to be your host today on Veterans Radio, a radio program for veterans, by veterans, for you. And today we're going to be talking about the Coast Guard. Their 225th anniversary is coming up this week. And so if we've got any Coast Guard veterans out there, we really want you to try and give us a call here on the program. The local number is 734-822-1600. 734-822-1600. And if you're calling from out at sea somewhere, you can call us toll free at 844-838-1600. 844-838-1600. Or you can send me an email during the program. Send it to dale@veteransradio.net. And we would love to get you on the program today to talk about your experiences in the Coast Guard. I was really kind of surprised that I was at a local Vietnam Veterans of America gathering today, and I was trying to say, is anybody here in the Coast Guard? And I couldn't find that many. And so we're counting on you out there. So in our listening audience, if you know any Coast Guard people, give us a call. A couple of big events are coming up, and I'll start with the most closest one, I guess it would be. And this is Thunder Over Michigan is coming up in the Ann Arbor, Michigan area, Ypsilanti area. And that's going to be on August 29th and 30th at the Willow Run Airport at the Yankee Air Museum. And this is their annual Thunder Over Michigan program where they're bringing in the Blue Angels. And they're going to be all kinds of precision flying, all kinds of aircraft, all sorts of demonstrations, static and in the air. There's going to be demonstrations of assaults from World War II, understand, up to Vietnam. So there's going to be all kinds of events. This is for you, and the whole family can go out there and have a great time. There'll be food, there'll be parking, there'll be just amazing men and women that you're going to be able to talk to. If you are an aircraft fanatic, you're going to see aircraft from 70 years ago right up to the current day, probably even older than 70 years. I know that there are also going to be helicopters out there. There's a B-52 static display. So it's really kind of neat. They've also got this great airplane simulator where when you get into this thing, it's for all you video gamers out there. This is for an adult video game, I think. You get in a simulated aircraft cockpit, and they can program it for just about every plane that I think has ever been built, and you get to try and fly this simulated aircraft. It's kind of cool. I did it myself, and I flew off the edge of the earth, but it was still fun, and much like I did when I went to flight school. So I guess my skills haven't changed that much. But that's coming up on August 29th and 30th. For more information, go to yankeeairmuseum.org, and you'll find all kinds of things out there. I think that's kind of cool. As I mentioned earlier, we had an event out at the VFW here in Ann Arbor, and they were celebrating celebrating is not quite the term I guess I would use. They were welcoming back all Vietnam War veterans, and so they had food and they had music, and it was really nicely done by the men and the auxiliary out there at the VFW Hall out on Wagner Road in Ann Arbor, and I want to thank them for all the work that they did to put this on. They've refurbished a Vietnam helicopter out there from the 170th Assault Helicopter Company for all of you screaming bikinis out there. And I want to tell you a quick story. This is how the world has changed, right? So they refurbished this UH-1H helicopter from 1969 is when it was in Vietnam. And they painted it exactly as though it were part of the 170th Assault Helicopter Company, and their call sign were the bikinis. They had bikini blue for their first platoon, and bikini red for the second platoon, and their gunships were called the Buccaneers. And so anyway, on the front of every one of their helicopters, they had an attractive young woman in a bikini, which, you know, 50 years ago, we didn't care about. But I was talking to this young woman, about nine, and she was asking questions about the helicopter, and she looked at the nose art on the helicopter, and she says, I don't like that. And I said, why? What's the matter? And she says, it's just not right to have some poor woman on a bikini on the front of a helicopter. And I said, well, I said, well, we tried to, you know, we would name it after somebody, and she thought maybe we should name it after her. And I'm not going to give her a name because I don't want to get anybody in trouble. But so I said, well, you know, what is your name? She told me. I said, well, maybe if we have a helicopter now, we would name it after you. And she says, well, that would be nice, but no pictures in bikinis. So, you know, the world has changed slightly. But that was fun. So, again, congratulations to the VFW out there. Speaking of the Vietnam veterans, the Vietnam Veterans of America Chapter 310 is coming up with their 13th annual pig roast on September 13th of 2015. And the cost is only $10. And it's going to be located at the same post. VFW Post 423 is on South Wagner Road in Ann Arbor. It's going to run from noon to 4 p.m. There'll be entertainment, face painting, silent auctions, helicopter tank static displays, playground structures. All proceeds will be going to assisting veterans projects, their Christmas and Halloween programs at the Ann Arbor Veterans Administration in Ann Arbor. So I encourage you to come on out on September 13th. Mark it on your calendar. And come on down. Maybe we'll see you out there. It's really kind of, they've got a great, if you feel like you're up north when you're at the VFW Post 423 down there on South Wagner Road. So mark your calendar, September 13th, 2015, and I hope to see you there. The cost is $10, and these guys are, and women are out there roasting pigs for hours and hours just for you. So it's really a kind of a neat thing. We also picked up another event that's coming up, and this is for the state of Michigan. And I want to remind everybody, if you've got an event coming up that you would like us to promote, whether it's in Michigan or around the world, please send us an email and we'll try to get it on the program, or we'll have you on so that you can announce it and tell us what's going on. Just send an email to either or me, Dale at Veterans Radio, or my partner Bob Gould at Bob at Veterans Radio, and we'll try and get you on the air as soon as we possibly can. All right, so I run into this young lady, Lynn O'Brien, who happens to be a director of district affairs for Senator Mike Colwell of the 15th District here in Michigan. And guess what? All you Vietnam veterans, I think there's some sort of guilt thing going on out there because suddenly everybody wants to welcome us home and say thank you and so on and so forth, you know, 50 years later. But I think they're very sincere with this. But this is going to be at the Michigan Capitol Building on Thursday, October 8th. I know it's a couple of months out, but write it on your calendar, Thursday, October 8th at noon. It's called Michigan Says Thanks. And so for more information on this, you can go to www.michigansaysthanks.com. And we'll be talking more about this. I know Bob is going to have somebody from this organization on his program on the 16th, I believe it is. So that's all the news that there is to talk about, except for one last thing. I just got an email right now. Give me a second here. It says, ailing U.S. veteran wins payout over Agent Orange exposure in Okinawa. This is a big deal, folks. For any of you that were exposed to Agent Orange out there, the VA has been sort of playing games with it, and I'm not talking about particular VA hospitals, but, you know, the bigwigs down there in Washington. At one time, they said that the only people that can file Agent Orange claims are those who had boots on the ground in Vietnam. And lo and behold, we find out that many of the blue water sailors and many of the brown water sailors and stuff on during the Vietnam time period were exposed to Agent Orange because they were bringing in the barrels and so forth, and they were spraying Agent Orange at different military bases, including on Okinawa. And so this is a very big deal that the Department of Veterans Affairs granted compensation to a former service member for exposure to Agent Orange while stationed in Okinawa during the Vietnam era. Big deal. So if you were, even if you were not in country in Vietnam during that time period and you think you were exposed to Agent Orange, you better start thinking about filing those claims and at least filing out what's going on. I was talking to another woman today about the legacy of Agent Orange, and we talked about this a couple of weeks ago, that they're now finding that the Agent Orange is being passed down, or the herbicide that is causing all these problems for exposure to Agent Orange is being passed down from generation to generation, and at least down three or four generations they're talking about. So we're going to be talking more about the evils of Agent Orange in the next couple of weeks, but if you were exposed to it and you're my age, you're in your mid to late 60s, get checked out, not just for you, but for your, you know, your legacy, your children, your grandchildren. If they start having problems and there's no explanation, it could be that Agent Orange. So keep up the good fight out there, all of you veterans that were exposed to Agent Orange, whether you were in Vietnam or not, and let's get these people to pay up. They ask you to perform a valuable service for this country, and then they want to deny the benefits that you've earned. So don't forget, go to the VA, file your claims, find out what's going on. Enough of that, right? Okay, before I get down off my soapbox here, wow. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we're going to be talking with our guest today, and his name is Scott Price, and Scott serves as the acting chief historian of the United States Coast Guard, and I'm really excited to talk about the Coast Guard because I'm going to find out some more about it. My dad was in the Coast Guard, and he didn't tell me all the stuff I needed to know. So we'll be right back with Scott Price. You're listening to Veterans Radio. Semper Paratus, always ready. It's the official Coast Guard marching song. Maybe we just have an instrumental version of that if I want to try it for other breaks, but it's always nice to hear the words of what these songs mean. And we'll talk a little bit about this song as we get into our interview. But right now I want to welcome to the program Scott Price, who is the acting chief historian of the United States Coast Guard. And so, Scott, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Hi, Dale. Thank you very much for having me.
Thank you very much for agreeing to be on the program. As I mentioned in our emails and stuff, my dad was in the Coast Guard. He was on an LST-884 during World War II, and I was talking to I had to go to a Navy guy to to find out about LSTs today. So we'll get into that a little bit more later on.
Oh, I'd love to.
But so. You know, the Coast Guard is coming up on its 225th anniversary, which is, I mean, that's older than anybody, right?
Well, no, not quite anybody. I think the Army's got us beat there. And I'm trying to think. The Navy claims it goes back to the Continental era, but there was a break from we were formed in August 4, 1790, and so for 7 years, our cutters were the only armed vessels afloat of the United States government. And the United States Navy came about in, I think it was 1797. So there was a period there where we were the sole military force on the water. So that's why we gently claim that we are the oldest maritime.
I think probably the Navy should have come under the control of the Coast Guard instead of the other way around.
Yeah, I think that's what they teach the cadets their first year at the Coast Guard Academy. We're the force that the Navy rallies around in times of war. But no, we're not.
We don't want to offend anybody in the Navy.
It's all in fun.
Right. So tell me about how this whole thing got started.
Yeah, we trace our birthday. It'll be, Tuesday, August 4th.
Right.
That's when George Washington signed the Tariff Act of 1790. And in that act, his Secretary of the Treasury, Alexander Hamilton, who we consider to be our father, had put in a request to build 10 seagoing cutters that would head to sea to protect the tariff, which was the only means of financing the government at the time. Remember, back then, you had no income tax. So
Right. Imports,
the duties on imports were an important part of the revenue for the federal government. And we were basically making sure that the ships weren't smuggling things in. So that was our first mission. We had those 10 cutters. George Washington signed it, and then we've gone from there.
How much did they allot for those cutters?
I think it was just $1,000 a piece.
That would be a lot of money then, wouldn't it?
Yeah, it was, but not that much. And a couple of them came in over budget, but hey, we got all 10 afloat. And but that's how small it was. But anyway, that was our start. And from that point forward, I've always said that we've grown with the nation. The Coast Guard itself is formed from 5 different agencies.
Yeah, could you explain that to our audience?
Sure. In 1790, we started off. It was basically called just the seagoing arm of the customs branch. Our cutters were able to go well out to sea, and the nation saw the use in that. So from that point forward, their law enforcement mission expanded, along with our defense responsibilities. You know, we were the sole defense force against the quasi-war, and we then started working with the Navy from that point forward. So we've always basically had a military character. And today we are the fifth armed force of the United States. We're not under DOD. We're under DHS. But we're still, I always have to repeat this. Most people don't understand that we're, because we're under a civilian agency.
Okay, so the
we are still military. We are always military.
Right.
Our folks in uniform carry the card. So,
but you're
we're
not
just
under
a little different.
Yeah, but you're not under the control of the Department of Defense. You're under the Department of Homeland Security.
Unless the president directs us to go back under the Navy, which has really only happened as a service twice. But let me go over the lineage here. The U.S. Life-Saving Service came about starting really in the 1840s, but didn't come about as an actual service until the 1870s. And they established small boat stations around the coastline of the United States. And these were the surfmen who would go out and rescue folks that were stranded or, you know, their ship was sinking right off the coast. The government merged the Revenue Cutter Service, which is what the cutter system ended up becoming, with the Life-Saving Service in 1915. And then in 1939, the Lighthouse Service, which is another venerable old, wonderful service of the government, that was merged with the Coast Guard right before World War II. And then during the war, we had the Bureau of Marine Inspection and Navigation come in temporarily during the war, and then after the war that transfer was made permanent. So the Bureau of Marine Inspection and Navigation had been the old Steamboat Inspection Service and then the Bureau of Navigation. Those two were merged when they were under the Department of Commerce to become the Bureau of Marine Inspection and Navigation. I think it was in 1933. But as I say, by 1946, then you see the modern character of the Coast Guard, where we have these five old services all coming together to form the Coast Guard and what the Coast Guard is today and what everybody should know about us.
Should I? Well, we know a lot about what they do today. You know, you mentioned that they're under the control of the Department of Homeland Security unless the president brings them back. And so what are their primary duties today?
Well, we have 11 missions, and I don't know if I can recite them all off the top of my head, but they basically break down into three areas, maritime security, safety, and safety, security, and environmental response, and making sure that we take care of the marine environment. So we are the nation's primary law enforcement at sea.
Okay, and also you are responsible for search and rescue along the
coastline.
Right,
and also under like the maritime safety, search and rescue, law enforcement, and defense responsibilities, keeping the coastline safe, keeping our harbors safe. That's been kind of come to the forefront, I guess, after 9/11. But we do all that, and those are our missions every day, 24/7. You know, peace and war. We're always at work. We're doing what we were tasked with doing.
Well, we certainly know here in being in Michigan, where the saying is, you know, that we're favored by four out of the five Great Lakes. And you know, we always hear the stories about the Coast Guard rescue missions for the people that go out and they go ice fishing for some reason at the end of April, and they can't understand why the ice floe breaks off, and you know, the next thing they're on their way to Canada. And so the Coast Guard has to go out and get them, of course. We also have a Coast Guard icebreaker that I'm aware of that breaks through the canal up at the top of the lower Michigan.
Sure.
Keep the shipping canals open. And it's always been fascinating to me. It's something that I've kind of regretted over time. When I got out of the service myself, I thought about, you know, just briefly, unfortunately, but, you know, of going into the Coast Guard so I could continue flying helicopters, but because I love the idea of being able to go out and help people that get into trouble.
That's our core, you know, that, like I say, with the life-saving service, that's all they did was save life. And I always say that's the soul of the service, I think. I mean, there'll be some that might disagree with me on that, but I would say that for the majority, they take great pride in the fact that they know we're here to help. We're here to protect.
Well, I think
those,
everybody.
Those are wonderful things to know when you put on the uniform, that that's what you're going to go out and do.
Well, I mean the semper paratus is really true when it says always ready.
Right. We never know what's going to happen, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so we have to prepare for all kinds of contingencies and things. And we're usually the ones right there. When ships are coming in, when the hurricane's going out, we're ready to head out. As soon as that hurricane passes, our cutters are going out, our aircraft are going to go out, and our folks are going to risk their lives.
Well, as I mentioned before, you know, we've got a lot of Coast Guard stations around Michigan.
Oh, sure.
Where people can, you know, if you want to, you know, see the Coast Guard in action or just even not in action, you can see some of their cutters that they have here. What kind of I'm not Navy at all, I apologize. So what kind of ships does the Coast Guard have?
We've got everything from small boats, which again would go back to our days as the life-saving service where they would, you know, launch from the beach.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where we got the Serpent, and this would tie into your father's service with the LSDs. That's why the Navy recognized that we have that capability to the ice-breaking cutters, like you, what you're probably thinking of is Mackinac 2.
Right.
She's the big icebreaker up on the Great Lakes. But then again, a number of our buoy tenders are capable of breaking ice, and they also do it along the Northeast Coast, you know, making sure that the gas ships can get into Boston, and anytime things freeze up, that's a pretty important mission. So we've got anywhere from, say, 25 feet all the way up to, you know, our newest cutters, the Vertov class, which are beautiful, and I have yet to get on one, which is one of the things I hope to do. But so all the way through, and what's really interesting, especially as a historian, I'm not so sure if it'd be one somebody serving on one, but some of these cutters are old.
Mm-hmm.
Our medium endurance, the 210s, have been in service since the mid-60s.
How big is that?
210 foot. It's our medium endurance cutter. We have the 210s and the 270s are the famous class cutters. Those came about in the 80s, but these cutters from the 60s are still serving. And our high endurance cutters from the 60s, there's still a number of those still in service. So God bless those folks serving on those cutters. They're venerable, but hey, they're still out there protecting.
I think so. You mentioned the idea of buoy tenders.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think our audience here in Michigan would have a clue what a buoy tender is.
Yeah, these are vessels that are specifically designed. Now, all of our vessels are called cutters, and anything over 100 feet in length. And the buoy tenders are basically trace their lineage back to the life-saving service. And these are vessels specifically designed to service buoys, you know, lay them, you know, into the water and make sure they're at the appropriate location, pull them out of the water when necessary to send supplies to the light stations that might be a bit hard to get to. But they're all capable cutters. A number of them were used down after the Deepwater Horizon oil spill. You know, just,
mm-hmm. How far out are these buoys?
It varies in the Great Lakes, pretty much all over. They're marking all the shipping lanes, and they have to pull them up in the winter. So that's why you have the buoy tenders up on the Great Lakes, where they they're working all the time, and they have to watch that ice season. And as soon as the ice starts breaking and shipping's declared to be okay and open, then they go out and they lay the buoys again. So that's an annual activity for them.
Huh.
But the lighthouses are you know, an integral part of the ACE navigation, even in today's GPS. And then you have a huge lighthouse enthusiast community. I think Michigan has the most lighthouses in the country per state.
I think they do.
Yeah.
I had heard that rumor.
Yeah.
Before we're talking here with Scott Price, who's a historian for the United States Coast Guard, and we're celebrating their 225th anniversary, which is coming up on August 4th of this year. And so if you'd like to get in on the conversation, if you're a Coast Guard veteran, we'd love to hear your stories. You can give us a call here at Veterans Radio at 844-838-1600. That's toll-free, 844-838-1600. Or you can call us on a local landline, 734-822-1600. 734-822-1600. And we want to hear from you, or send me an email to dale@veteransradio.net, and we'll try to get your question on the air. As I mentioned when I contacted Scott, I'm fascinated about this whole thing because, my father was in the Coast Guard during World War II, and so I'm always trying to find out this information because he never bothered to fill me in.
Yeah, that was typical, actually.
That whole generation.
Yeah, and, they did their duty, but they didn't want to talk about it.
Right. And so when we come back, we've got about, how much time have we got? I got about a minute. Okay. When we come back, we're going to talk about the role of the Coast Guard in World War II and earlier on. So
sure.
I'm going to let you put on your thinking cap while we do that, and maybe there's some interesting stories that you've got that you can pass along to our audience about some of these great heroes that were in the Coast Guard, which we never hear about.
That's true.
That's right. So I want to remind everybody, stay tuned. We're going to be coming back here and talking about the Coast Guard and their birthday in the next couple of minutes. Semper Paratus, always ready. I bet you didn't know we could fit an orchestra inside the studio, did you? The national, I guess you could call it the theme music of the United States Coast Guard, which are going to be celebrating their 225th anniversary on August 4th. And our guest today is Scott, Scott Price, who is currently the acting chief historian of the United States Coast Guard, and his areas of interest, they say, are the Coast Guard's role during the 20s, 30s, World War II. I can't wait to talk about those time periods. If you've got a question for Scott or you've were served in the Coast Guard, give us a call here at Veterans Radio at 844-838-1600, 844-VET-1600, or you can call us in southeastern Michigan at 734-822-1600. Before we took the break, Scott, we were just talking about where the Coast Guard is today. Now let's kind of go back and look at how they became, the different conflicts that they were involved in, if you could do that for us.
Yeah, sure. We, like I said, we started off, the first one was the quasi-war with France. And then from every major conflict from that point forward, we've been involved. Civil War, Spanish-American War, World War One, which we're coming up on the 100th anniversary. And we're going to be, you know, the commemorative events for that are coming up. Then there was World War II, Korea, Vietnam, was we're the 50th anniversary. You were talking about this
right.
The show started. That we're also involved with that. 8,000 Coast Guardsmen served in Vietnam. Desert Shield, Desert Storm, Operation Iraqi Freedom, and we've even had folks, you know, Enduring Freedom. We've had folks serving in Afghanistan. So anytime the nation's gone to war, we're right there.
Well, that's all right. Let's go back to the Civil War, just for a moment. What did the Coast Guard do in the Civil War? Was it their protecting the coast or trying to stop
basically
people
running? Right? And it was supporting the Navy. We actually fired the first naval shot of the war before the war actually started, when a vessel tried to enter Charleston Harbor without displaying the national ensign.
Oh, okay.
The cutter Harriet Lane, which I always thought was one of our best-looking cutters ever, fired a shot across her bow. And, you're going to obey the law. And so that was our claim to fame there. And we were protecting ports and then serving with our cutters were serving with the Navy. And that's been a theme, basically. We're there whenever the Navy needs us. And the only two times we've actually... Once the Coast Guard was formed, it was specifically stated in law that we are an armed force of the United States, and that still applies today. But it also said that we could be transferred as an entire service under the Navy, and that's only happened twice, in World War One and World War Two.
Okay.
After that time, it's basically been the Navy has asked us for certain units or certain capabilities that we specialize in, and they will take those.
Oh, okay.
So in Vietnam, the cry went out for brown water cutters that could actually, get in close to the shore. And that's still going on right now. We have cutters serving in the Persian Gulf. And then our specialty, with the port security, those folks are always working. And we have port security units that rotate in. One's in Guantanamo. So when it comes to defense missions, that's a primary mission. It still is today.
Well, it sounded like the Coast Guard's everywhere. What did they do during the Spanish-American War? Were they down there protecting the Maine?
They served again with the Navy as individual cutters, and One, the Hudson, during the assault, one of the assaults in Cuba, actually rescued a Navy gunboat that was badly damaged. And these folks, you know, made history and got congressional gold medals for their bravery. At that point, they technically, while serving with the Navy, they weren't necessarily, you know, uniformed members of the military forces.
Mm-hmm.
And they couldn't get medals of honor. So Congress gave them gold medals of honor, which I always thought was, you know, important in a unique, very, very unique way.
Yeah. Did they change that? Or
yeah, well, once the Coast Guard was created in 1915, it was stated in law that they are part of the armed forces of the United States.
Okay.
And so from that point forward, there's never been any ambiguity about our status.
Mm-hmm.
And so now we're, you know, eligible, subject to the UCMJ and eligible for all the military awards that are out there. And that would, you know, take us up. World War One, we were integrated more closely with the Navy. It's fascinating if you really look at it. We had officers commanding Navy warships.
Oh, I bet that went over well.
It did. It worked fine because the Navy recognized right off the bat that these men that had been serving at sea had been serving at sea.
Mm-hmm.
They knew how to handle large ships in any kind of weather. And we also had cutters serving out Gibraltar. We lost one. That was one of our greatest combat losses ever. During World War One, when we had the USCGC Tampa sunk with all hands off England, she was running convoy duty. And
we hope one day to go
find her. I'd like to. That would be one of my hopeful events to do in the future, mm-hmm. is to go look for her.
I think I read about that. You've got a great website. The Coast Guard's got a great website as far as the history is concerned, and there's a number of other websites where you can, for those of you that are really interested in military history, can just go online and find all kinds of things under the U.S. Coast Guard or the National Coast Guard Association Museum has some really cool information, and I want to talk briefly about that later on.
I wanted to mention, too, with your father, that we during World War II, it was a little different than World War One. We were, the Navy kept us basically as a unit, and then we would also crew Navy vessels pretty much entirely with Coast Guard crews. We all called them Coast Guard manned Navy vessels.
It was very,
and that included 77 LSTs, which must be what your father was on. And
right.
We'd have a web page up for each LST with as much photography as I could find on each one. So I'm not sure what's up there for your father's. But
well, I can tell you, we did a program on the Coast Guard, I don't know, about 8 years ago or so. My dad passed away in 1962. And during the program, our production assistant, you know, came over the headphones. She says, "We've got a call for you on the phone." I'm going, "What a call? Really? Cool." And this really old voice came on, and he says, "I knew your dad."
Oh, no. That's wonderful.
And the next thing I know, we got connected, and his son, who's my age, sent me a bunch of pictures I had never seen. And it was just fascinating to find out a little bit more about them, because they had been on Iwo Jima. We have a picture of the ship on the beach, and then in Okinawa, as they were getting ready to I guess for the landing, they got hit by a kamikaze plane, and it was set afire, and so they all jumped into the ocean, and they lost a number of Marines that were down in the hole of the ship, and my dad had gone back on the ship, and then they were towed back, and by then the war was over. But I was talking to a Navy guy today who was on an LST, and I was asking him, you know, for those of you out there that might be interested in this, it's a little over 300 feet long, and it's a flat-bottom ship. And its maximum speed is 17 knots, he said.
Mm-hmm.
And so it took 2 months for them to go from the west coast of the United States to Iwo Jima. And I guess they stopped by in Saipan. I'm finding out more and more about this as we go along. But 2 months at sea with a flat-bottom ship, which evidently during storms is not a nice ride.
You earn your money.
I know. So we have all these pictures now, thank God, of, you know, of all of these men, many of my father, with this ship, you know, it's all twisted up. And it's really nice to find that stuff out. But as you said, there are many associations out there now for each individual ship. So I'm going to go into your website and see if you have some pictures I haven't seen yet.
Sure. I mean, that's been one of the most rewarding parts of my job. Was I came on board in 1993, and that was right about the height of the 50th anniversary of World War II commemoration.
Mm-hmm.
And dealing with these World War II veterans has been probably one of the highlights of my career so far. It's been wonderful connecting them with each other. I got to know the crew of the Spencer from World War II, which was one of our larger high endurance cutters. And they had actually been in combat on convoy duty in the North Atlantic and had attacked and sunk the U-175 right in the middle of the Atlantic. And there was a combat photographer on board from St. Louis who captured it all on still film. And I posted photos up. But lo and behold, the survivors of that U-boat crew wanted to get back in touch with the survivors of the Coast Guard crew. So here you have this 50 years later, you know, what had been a combat on the North Atlantic turning into a reunion of fellow sailors.
I find that fascinating, Scott, and I've run into that myself, where people on opposite sides during these wars come together and they find out that they were both, you know, they were warriors themselves.
They were all kids.
Yeah, that's the other thing.
What's really funny is when you think these kids were 18 and 19, 20 years old, you know.
Right, and they have so much in common. 50 years later, they can look back on it and can understand it probably a little bit more than they did when they were 18 and 19.
Right.
And because we've had fighter pilots that went up against, you know, Messerschmitts and Zeros, and they've met the pilots of those aircraft, and they just get along. You know, the mutual respect, I guess, is what you could call it.
Yeah.
And kind of this mutual admiration society that, wow, you guys were doing the same thing I was, and look, we survived. How did this happen? Which is
even going on in Vietnam. I mean, part of my background has been aviation history, and I've been reading about some of the Air Force and Navy pilots who connected with some of the North Vietnamese pilots they flew against.
Right.
You know, it's. I guess time does heal wounds, and the chance to reflect. And
evidently, it does, because there are a lot of people that are trying, the Vietnam veterans that are, you know, they're going back to Vietnam and finding that, you know, it's a beautiful country. It was a beautiful country when we were there, and that they're welcoming, you know, Americans with open arms, which is, you know, sort of surprising.
But that's, you know, one of the benefits of doing what I do is that you get that connection to folks,
people that
actually made that history. And
it sounds like it. You mentioned the Spencer in the Atlantic. Do you have any stories like that in the Pacific or anything
else?
Well,
yeah, the most famous, of course, and I got yelled at one time because I forgot to mention Douglas Monroe in an interview I did. And he's basically, I think, it's a tough statement to say, but I'd say he's probably our most famous Coast Guardsman of the 20th century. Young man out of Washington State, joined the Coast Guard before the war and ended up in the Guadalcanal. And they formed a Coast Guard officer, Dwight Dexter, actually formed the boat pool. The Coast Guard ran the small boats that were running. As soon as the Marine Corps landed, we landed. We were right there with them. We were manning assault transports. And as I said earlier, the Navy and the Marine Corps recognized right on, early on, that a lot of our surfmen along these coasts know how to handle small boats in shoal waters. And Doug was one of them. And he ended up volunteering to pull out a bunch of, was it a battalion of Marines? And the Marine Corps still remembers his name. He was killed in action evacuating Marines who were been surrounded and under attack, and he is so far our only Medal of Honor winner. We've named a cutter after him, and I think there'll always be a Monroe in the cutter fleet from now on because of him. So
I'll have to go look up his citation. We have a segment which we didn't play today, unfortunately, but we usually honor a Medal of Honor recipient every week, and
I know we'd appreciate it if you would.
I know exactly the guy to record it too.
Okay.
And it's always amazing, you know, all the Medal of Honor recipients that we've had the privilege of talking to on this program that have survived, because the vast majority of Medal of Honor recipients are, you know, posthumously issued, but they're all so humble. And they all feel like they're so lucky, and they all represent all of the other people that were around them.
Right.
And it's always amazing to me that all of these particular men are that way. And and it's not just generational anymore. We've talked to the newest ones from Iraq and Afghanistan, and their attitude is exactly the same.
The warrior spirit does seem to carry on.
It does.
Yeah.
So let's talk about you mentioned that they were on Guadalcanal. We know they were on Iwo Jima and that they were underneath the control, or not underneath the control. They controlled their own ships. Oh, I have a quick story. I was talking to a man a couple of weeks ago that was in the Navy that was on an LST. And I said, oh, my dad was on an LST. And he says, oh, really? He was in the Navy? I said, no, he was in the Coast Guard. And I thought he was just, he just gave me the sourest look. Oh, one of them. And I said, hey, you know, he was doing his job just like you were. And I think it's fascinating the way that everybody was able to cooperate, all of the services.
Yeah, most of the World War II veterans, that would be one of the questions I would always ask them. Was there any rivalry? Was there any, you know, put-downs? I mean, no one ever said there was. You have that, what do you want to call, friendly rivalry?
Yeah.
The Coast Guard was, back then we had Navy uniforms, and we'd have a different cap device, and there was a shield. The Coast Guard shield would be on the right foresleeve of all the enlisted folks.
Okay.
So that's how you would differentiate the Coast Guardsmen, but they wore the same uniforms.
Okay, because I was trying to figure it out, because my dad was a chief motorman's motor...
Motor machinist mate?
Yeah, that's the guy.
Oh, they call you, yeah, the nickname was the Motor Mac.
Right.
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 Yeah, they're the ones that kept things running.
Right. Evidently he did. I didn't even know that. I didn't... I said, what do you know about diesel engines? And I'll tell you someday. Well, you know, I never got around to telling me this story. So tell me about what are some of the opportunities in the Coast Guard? I'm looking at the website for the Museum Association right now, and they've got this really great picture of this Coast Guard cutter. And do they? And there is a Coast Guard Academy, correct?
Yes, it's in New London, Connecticut. There is an effort to build a national Coast Guard museum nearby in downtown New London.
So can you tell me a little bit about the academy and what do they do, and you know, what is their mission, do you know?
Their mission is to train the next generation of officers. I know they encourage all qualified applicants. What's interesting about the Coast Guard Academy versus the others is that you don't need to get a congressional nomination.
Oh, okay.
It's a merit-based system, a four-year program. And when you get out, you've got a job serving with the Coast Guard.
And you come out as an ensign?
Ensign, right.
Okay.
Or 01.
01. That part I can think of.
Sure.
That was definitely...
We have direct commissions, too, so I would encourage anyone interested in checking. I think it's gocoastguard.com.
Okay.
But well, the enlisted folks are you know, marvelous, too. So we love all our Coasties.
That's what somebody said the other day, and I said, is that what they really want to be called, Coasties?
Yes, I think it's a term I've used. It might vary, you know, times change, but so far I haven't gotten punched or anything.
Well, that's always good. We're talking with Scott Price, a historian for the Coast Guard, and we wanted to take another real quick break here. And we're going to go back out, and we're going to do a couple of PSAs and so forth. And we'll come back, and we're hoping that you guys have some of you Coasties out there have a question. When we come back, we're going to kind of do a little review and try and encourage people to find out more about the United States Coast Guard, 225 years old on August 4th. So, wow. So we'll be right back after this short message. And we're back, and we're celebrating the 225th anniversary of the United States Coast Guard, Semper Paratus, always ready. And I'm sitting here talking with Scott Price, who's a Coast Guard historian, which is kind of a cool job. I wish I'd thought of that about 50 years ago. So I was listening to this music, and I love this particular anthem, I guess you could call it. My son is a band director, and so he plays a lot of marches and so forth, and he played this one time, and I said, wow, what is that? And he says, that's the Coast Guard. And I'm going,
yeah, it's pretty stirring, isn't it?
It is stirring, and so I looked it up, and there's all kinds of different versions of it. They kind of upgrade it depending on the conflict at the time, but it is, words and music are by Captain Francis Saltus Van Boskirk.
Yeah.
Wow.
Officer that's in the 20s, I don't know if I get the story exactly right, he was serving up in Alaska. We have an Alaska patrol that we've called the Bering Sea Patrol, and you talk about your arduous duties.
Yeah, I can imagine.
You know, the Bering Sea in wintertime. But when he was on shore one time, he had I'm not sure what city it was, Kiskut. No, anyway, there was a piano, so he realized that the Coast Guard needed its own anthem and composed it. And as you've noted, it was, I guess, in the early 30s when it became adopted as our official anthem. And then some of the lyrics have changed to update them. But it's a pretty stirring song.
It is very stirring. It says that I've got it here. I got it probably off of your guys' website. Yeah, United States Coast Guard .mil. Yeah, he wrote the song in Unalaska.
Unalaska,
Unalaska, Alaska. Clever names up there.
Yes.
But it said it was the only piano in the whole long chain of Aleutian Islands, a beat up old piano. He wrote the song and received his commission in the Revenue Cutter Service in 1891. And it's a very powerful song. And he was also a censor. It says he was the first Coast Guard officer to report a German submarine in the Atlantic coast during World War I.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. These guys are. There's amazing stories here about all these different services folks out there. And I want to remind people that, you know, that there is another service other than the big four. And so the opportunity, if you are thinking about or you have somebody that is thinking about joining a service, I think the Coast Guard might be somewhere to look. Because evidently they get to go all over the world as well.
Yes, we do. But, you know, we're here. We're here to protect the
mm-hmm.
country. And just like the other armed services, but we're doing it 24/7. So the job is always there. And we're patrolling the coast. We're pulling folks out of the water. We're preventing oil spills. And if they do have a spill, we try to help clean it up. And there's peacetime missions, and then we're ready in case the nation needs us in case of war too. So that's what makes it fun. And as you noted, there's the variety of history is enough to intimidate any historian. You're trying to figure out five different services, five different histories, five different sets of heroes and cultures, and you know the Coast Guard is carrying on all of those and for 225 years. Well,
I find it very fascinating that you have dug into these things. I'm going to have to read more and more of some of what you have published, your articles and so forth, about the Coast Guard, because I think it's just a fascinating part of our history. And I didn't realize that they were as part of our entire history, you know, right from the beginning
from the beginning, that very first Congress.
And the idea that they, you know, like, I love the story about they got $1,000 to build these boats, and some of them were a little bit more expensive, so they got money from other people. Or they found money in different areas, and how they had to be, you know, to find the funds to build these ships. Because I guess, you know, these were seagoing ships, right?
Right, right. That was the whole idea behind them: get out of the harbor and get out to sea. And that's what Alexander Hamilton's ultimate aim was, I think.
Yeah. These are the ships that we see and we saw in the movies.
Right.
Kind of things. Not the little brown water motorboats and so forth that, you know, that we kind of associate sometimes with the Coast Guard with their smaller ships.
Yeah, those are just as important. But, you know, we've got, like I said, actually, I remembered a cutter is 65 feet and longer. It used to be back in the day that it had to be 100 feet and longer.
Mm-hmm.
But 65 feet, those are our cutters. And we've got the new class coming online, and they've been serving now since, I think, the first one came out in 08. And we're going to need to upgrade our medium endurance cutters, and hopefully that'll happen soon. But
you mentioned
some of these are old.
Well, you know, it's the way the military works sometimes. How many active duty members of the Coast Guard are there? Do you have any idea?
I'm not totally up on all the current numbers, but it's right around 38,000 to 40,000.
And
that's active duty uniformed. There are 7,000 civilians, give or take. We have an auxiliary that are our uniformed volunteers,
mm-hmm.
and we have a reserve, and I think the reserves are around 10. So all told, near 70,000.
Okay. And there are lots of jobs for women in the Coast Guard, I'll bet you.
We have no restrictions,
mm-hmm.
and we haven't. We've always – that's one of the things I've been most proud of is studying this history. That's one of the – things we've had in our culture was whatever needs to be done to get the job done, we will do, regardless of what social convention will tell us. So we allowed women on cutters in 1977, well before the Navy ever did.
Mm-hmm.
There is no restrictions. Women come on board, they can serve anywhere they want.
That's
something I've always thought was really, really cool about our service.
It is kind of cool, and they have really cool helicopters, folks. A lot of really neat rescue helicopters, and I'm fascinated by those, of course. And
are you a rotorhead?
I was a rotorhead, absolutely. just Hueys.
We've got fixed wing too, so yeah, rotorheads and fixed wing folks, and both. We've got dual qualified pilots.
Are they required to be a college graduate, or is it just if you get a license, you can?
No, I believe, yeah, for you have to be a commissioned officer to actually control the aircraft.
Okay, and commissioned is a college graduate?
Yes, and we have direct commission programs, but again, you'd have to go on gocoastguard.com to
mm-hmm.
learn all the details. But if there's areas that they're looking to fill, but yes. But if you're not a college graduate, you want to enlist, every job you have is important. Every job we do is important. But your rescue swimmers are enlisted.
Mm-hmm.
And you talk about some of the bravest people we have in service. They're amazing. And
well,
you read about their rescues, and it's just mind-boggling.
It is mind-boggling, and you have to admire them, and thank goodness that they're out there and that there's somebody that's willing to do those jobs. And I'm excited to find out more about the Coast Guard. Scott, I want to thank you very, very much for being on Veterans Radio today. And I encourage people to find out more information about the United States Coast Guard, 225 years young, on August 4th, 2015. I think you're going to have a great time finding information out about this. I think, you know, kind of not thought about service as much as it should be. So thanks very much, Scott.
Well, it's my pleasure, Dale. And please keep me in mind if you ever want to talk about Coast Guard history again.
I will do that. I will do that. Thank you very much for being on
Veterans Radio. I've enjoyed it. Thank you, sir.
Thank you. All right, folks, that's it for Veterans Radio again in the United States Coast Guard. So now you've got another member of the military to thank for their service of their country, and we want to make sure that the Coast Guard gets their proper recognition that they should. Next week we're going to be back on Veterans Radio, and we're going to be talking about the dropping of the bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. So until next week, you've been listening to Veterans Radio, and you are dismissed.